The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Cabinet ministers yesterday were given a stark warning to rein in their spending or face a difficult budget in October. I'm joined in studio by Pascal Donoghue, Minister for Public Expenditure, President of the Eurogroup and Fine Gael TD for Dublin Central. Minister, good morning.
Good morning to you, Pat.
Now, you're just back from Washington. What was your mission?
So twice a year, all the finance ministers across most countries in the world meet in Washington to attend a meeting organised by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And I attend those meetings in my role to represent the euro and all the countries inside the euro. And at those meetings, I explain the work that we're doing in Europe and look at how we can cooperate with other parts of the world, such as America and the developing world. And I came away with a real sense of how the world is changing and the contribution that Ireland and Europe can make to us.
Now, to borrow from Sean O'Casey, the world's in a state of chassis.
It very much is. The two challenges that were so clear from last week and from all the engagements I've had in 2024 have been, firstly, the impact of the two wars and conflicts, what is happening in the Middle East, what is happening in the war on the people of Ukraine. And then secondly, so many of what used to be called developing economies that have their debts dominated in the dollar, the value of those debts is growing and their growth is actually going down as well for many of them. And the responsibility that we have to those parts of the world to help them cope with that change, it's very much in our interest to do that.
Now, what tools do the G7 have at their disposal, the World Bank at their disposal, the IMF at their disposal?
So two, for in particular dealing with either the war on the people of Ukraine or what's happening in the developing world. For example, for supporting the people of Ukraine, it's the funding that has been made available to them. So the European Union made 50 billion euro worth of funding available to support the economy of Ukraine for the next 3 years. The IMF has made additional financial support available. America on Saturday night voted through a further 60 billion euro worth of aid. Now,
the Americans are giving effectively military aid to Ukraine, and that's what Zelensky has been looking for because they can't defend themselves. They're running out of simple armaments, shells and so on. Where does the European money go? Is it to keep the civil service going, to keep teaching in schools, to keep hospitals running?
So the European Union is the largest single supporter of financial aid to the Ukrainian economy and to the people of Ukraine, as we should be. It's a war that's happening on our borders. It's a war that can have such an effect on the future security and prosperity of Europe and the European Union. In terms of where our money is going, it's a mixture. Much of it is going to simply meeting the financing needs of the Ukrainian economy itself to ensure their state can continue to function. And then bilaterally, lots of other countries that are members of the European Union are then stepping up with the supply of either money for weapons and armaments or the direct supply of them.
And we are not.
So the main contribution we're making to that funding is we are contributing to a financial instrument in the European Union called the Peace Facility, but which in turn is supplying military support to Ukraine. But our stipulation is that our funding is used to acquire non-lethal military equipment.
Okay, that could include uniforms?
So it could include defence, it could include equipment that people wear to protect themselves in case they're
even though they might be in combat,
kind of,
like so, for example, bulletproof vests.
That is would exactly be... it, and that kind of support, which we believe is consistent with our neutral stance, while also recognising that the development of this war is something that Ireland has an interest in.
In terms of Gaza, what was the consensus coming out of your meeting?
Well, when we were there, the latest development in the conflict or potential conflict between Iran and Israel took place, when Israel responded back with a military response to, in turn, the attack on them by drones and missiles earlier on in the week. The overall sense for many of the democracies that were there is the role that we all need to play in bringing about a ceasefire, in trying to begin what will be a very long political process towards a long-term settlement in the Middle East. But sitting alongside that was also a recognition that the overall Middle East, the role that many other countries are playing in the world is increasing because of their growing wealth and their growing economic prosperity. And a very telling sign of this is the new chair of the International Monetary Fund is from Saudi Arabia. So it's another example of how the economic and political order in the world is changing. But of course, where we're focused at the moment is the role that Ireland can play in the Middle East in bringing about peace, which is why, for example, the Taoiseach is in Egypt at the moment and why we've made our views very clear in terms of the attack on Gaza and on the people of Palestine, while also condemning what happened on October the 7th.
We talk about democratic nations, and you really, if you're truly democratic, you have to accept whatever the electorate dish up. And we're seeing in parts of the world the growth of the right wing. So how do traditionalists who look at the right wing with dismay, how do they cope with a belief in democracy and yet an accepting of views which are fundamentally anathema to us?
So fundamentally, as you have just said in your question, it is in the essence of democracy and respecting our democratic institutions that you have to respect at all times the will of the people, whether expressed through a referenda are expressed in parliamentary and presidential elections. But for people like me who have very strong views regarding the future of representative democracy and the threat posed by the very far right and even at times the really far left, I think it is so important that we are able to make the case for respecting democratic institutions, respecting our judiciary, respecting fair elections, and at the same time having economic policies in place that respond back to the concerns that people do have regarding how economies and societies can respond back to issues that are of real concern.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at mature democracies, and we can even include Germany in that, given how they have united and survived, if you like, the remnants of their Nazi past. But mature democracies take one kind of view. Within the EU, though, you've got countries like Hungary, which you might regard as the spy in the cab when it comes to Russia. You know, they lean still towards the east. And as we allow more countries in to the eastern front of the EU, they're not as mature and as maybe steadfast in their view. If it suits them, they might lean towards Moscow again.
It's still worth acknowledging that despite the strong views of President Orbán, the European Union has been able to agree on extraordinary levels of financial support for the people of Ukraine, even if there have been differing views as part of that process along the way. But overall, you make a really important and fair point, and it's something Ireland needs to consider very carefully. Firstly, we have many, many countries that joined the European Union, and I think of the miracle that are the Baltic Republics, Lithuania, Latvia and Estonia. And even though they're in a really different part of Europe, they're extraordinary democracies, have achieved amazing things for their people. And Ireland has a real shared interest in working with those people.
But they have the Russian bear on their doorstep.
And not only do they have that, they have very large Russian minorities within their own countries. At times, even Russian minorities.
Isn't that the trick that Putin plays, using a Russian minority, as he did in Ukraine, to usurp the democratic government of Ukraine?
But I'd make the counterexample, despite the fact that there are very large vocal Russian minorities within countries like that. Those Baltic republics have been able to elect and re-elect governments that are completely supportive of the European Union and see their future inside the European Union. So we have countries, governments, political parties there who have engaged within their own democracies with countries that would have societies within them that would have a very strong Russian origin, and they still manage to convince very strong majorities, election after election, that their future lies in Europe. And what we need to be aware of, Pat, is over the long arc of the development of the European Union in the next 50 to 100 years, a European Union that includes the Balkans, a European Union that will include Ukraine within it, what that will mean for a country that is on the western arc of the European Union, an island off an island, and how we...
You mean the centre of gravity moves east? And we are, if you like, further isolated geographically, if not politically.
So I would see the centre of gravity as being in the centre of Europe and the axis of cooperation between France, Germany, Poland, those democracies being increasingly important in the future. And by those democracies, I mean the Baltic states, other countries that could yet join. And what we need to do, which we are doing, is look at how we can contribute to the growth of that democracy and secure our own interests in it as well, not least of which is economically, which myself and Minister Michael McGrath work hard on doing.
Now, turning to domestic issues, we're told there'll be a curb on spending, that you want fiscal rectitude from the Cabinet.
Actually, the point that I have made publicly is what we need to do, and I make this point year after year, is our spending plans need to be in line and broadly in line with what we agreed on Budget Day. At the moment, public expenditure is up nearly 14% at the end of the first quarter versus the same quarter a year ago.
And where is that going?
We're getting an awful lot for us. Well, for example, it's going into where we are on housing at the moment. It's going into the fact now that, you know, last year we delivered around 12,000 social homes. And we saw, for example, the delivery of 8,000 new bills last year. It's going into the fact of where we are in health, which for 2 years in a row, we saw our waiting lists fall. But the key point still needs to be that overall our spending for the year is in line with where we want it to be.
It's not in health. They're already over budget.
And we have this issue year after year, Pat. But it should be emphasised that we have over 1,000 more critical care beds in our system than we did before the pandemic. We've over 20,000 more staff in place, which is the reason why our waiting lists have fallen for 2 years in a row. But what I need to do, which I have to do again over a number of years, is work to bring spending into line with where we want it to be for the year. And the reason for that is, in turn, that gives us the ability to maintain this focus and this growth next year and next year's budget, while also keeping our country safe from economic risks.
Now, one of your jobs may be to supervise a redress scheme for the Stardust families. What is your view? The apology, by and large, seems to have gone down well with the families, but they want action now. Words are words, and the words, very telling and quite sincere from the Taoiseach, have been accepted as such. But now you move on.
We do need to move on, and I attended the Dáil for the entire session of statements and apologies yesterday afternoon. I heard the Taoiseach and all the party leaders speak, and I attended the full debate. And coming out of it all, I've three thoughts regarding how we move this forward. The first one is, yesterday was a day of apology. That day of apology had to be made, and we all need to reflect on how we got to this point. Secondly, there's a clear demand and expectation for accountability now from the survivors, from the family of all those who lost their life in the most tragic of circumstances. The state needs to consider on how we can move forward in relation to that need, an understandable need. And finally, then, the commemoration of all of this, we need to reflect on and how we can do that better. Redress has come up. I have to say, yesterday I didn't hear that come up from those who were representing the survivors who'd lost so much in that dreadful day over four decades ago. But of course, it's something we'll have to consider and engage with all those who've lost so much on.
I mean, at the heart of this seems to have been an institutional attitude on the part of the state to the kind of area where this happened. Now, you represent a constituency that has similar areas. I mean, is there that sense of alienation that the state doesn't really get the population of areas like that?
So I think undoubtedly there are some who do feel the state does not represent them or get them or act in their interests. And undoubtedly the emotion yesterday afternoon and the understandable emotion will have underlined that feeling amongst some. I'd have to make the case for my work dealing with those who lead the state, and I am one of them, that I do sincerely believe that the guiding impulse in all the decisions that I've seen made in my years in public life has been to do the right thing by our country, regardless of where you come from. But undoubtedly, coming out of yesterday, there is clear evidence that we need to reflect on about why that did not happen. And it's certainly a big area of reflection for me personally in looking at what happened yesterday.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, is there something about what has been traditionally the political class? You know, they come from a particular kind of educational background, a particular social stratum.
I can understand why that critique can be put forward. I can understand why someone would make the case. And I can, as I said, given the afternoon we had yesterday and given all the mourning, grief and alienation that has led up to yesterday taking place. I can simply say that in my experience in dealing with politicians in my own party and in other parties, regardless of where you come from, regardless of what your background is, I've always seen the guiding impulse is to try to do the right thing. You know, I've been very lucky to represent the people of Dublin Central now for three different all terms. They've elected me and re-elected me. And dealing with other politicians within Dublin Central and looking at what I've tried to do, regardless of where we come from or what part, what schools we went to and so on, I'm very aware that we try to do the right thing by those we look to represent.
Moving on to immigration, and there's a poll in the Irish Daily Mail today, and it does, I suppose, tie in with the notion that it will be one of the election issues, whether it's local, European or the national election. And just some of the headlines from it. Do you think the level of immigration to Ireland is too high, too low or about right? Too high, say 79%. I worry the government is in control of immigration in Ireland. 64% agree with that statement. I'm more concerned about immigration than I was a year ago. 64% agree with that statement. So it is a concern. We can look to the hard right, the hard left, whatever extremes and blame them. But this is a general population survey and people are concerned. We read on the same page, deportations have soared this year. We also hear that a huge proportion of the people seeking international protection are coming to us via Northern Ireland.
And
I mean, that's failure, failure, failure.
Well, I think you need to recognise that the movement, I would make the case that the root cause of this are issues that are not only beyond the control of Ireland, but beyond the control of many, many, many countries. We are seeing the
But we're doing things now. For instance, the new system whereby the country from which most international protection seekers are coming, and this might change from month to month and so on, but that country will then have its arrivals processed really quickly. Nigeria is top of the list at the moment. And, you know, it's not designated as entirely a safe country. Many parts of it are utterly safe, but it's a huge country. So these kind of actions could have been done years ago.
But I still have to make the case that the cause and the movement of people and the scale of movement of people is for reasons that are beyond the influence of most countries at the moment. We're seeing the largest movement of people across Europe and other parts of the world since World War II because of war and because of conflict. But all that being said, of course I accept and recognise that it's an issue of real concern to our own society that they expect to see us respond back to. We're looking to do that in three different ways. Number one, to implement the law that we have in relation to this effectively and fairly. Many who come to our country as migrants looking for status and protection are coming from the most awful and dreadful of circumstances. Secondly, implementing...
Sure, but we are deporting people now at a higher rate than we were doing it, which suggests that we weren't doing the job properly.
I don't accept that. That leads on to the second point that I was about to make, which is that we have to implement a deportation system fairly and effectively too. And we're doing that. Last year, we deported around 600 people. This year, so far, we're around 1,500 people. And then thirdly, what we have to do then is cooperate with other countries, which we're aiming to do within the European Union.
And there's a new system that will be pan-European.
Indeed, to come up with a better solution to this than we could.
What about the route into Ireland from Northern Ireland? I mean, when the UK was part of the European Union, it was a movement, if you like, within the EU. Now we are the back door into the EU via the UK. I mean, many people who make it across the channel, never interfacing perhaps with the authorities in the UK, can find a safe haven, knowing that there is, I was going to say a welcome on the mat. A tent is not exactly a welcome on the mat. But still, you know, good social welfare possibilities, full employment here. To be a successful economic migrant, Ireland might just be the place.
Well, we have a growing economy. We have an economy that has a very, very high level of employment within us. That undoubtedly does create a sense of an economic attraction or pull. But I don't think we will want to change our economy and reduce the number of jobs that we have just for changing that perceived incentive. We have an open border between ourselves and Northern Ireland. were part of an agreement with the United Kingdom regarding the freedom of movement of people. I believe that is a great prize. It's a great asset. I believe it's one we should maintain. In terms of how we do deal with the issue then regarding the attractiveness of country from an illegal migration point of view, it's in particular, it goes back to the point then I made about how we implement our deportation system. And that is growing in terms of the number of people who are being deported. We've put an increased focus into being able to turn around the applications in relation to residency in our country as well. They're being processed far quicker than they have been before. But I would just go back very briefly to the human point that I made. From meeting people who are coming to Ireland, looking for international protection, looking for a status within our country, they are fleeing. The vast majority of them are coming from circumstances of misery that are beyond my own imagination at times.
And at the same time, though, we were very tardy in designating certain countries as safe.
Well, what we've done is change our international protection system to reflect the fact now that the reality of the number of people who are moving across the world and Europe has increased. And as I said, only at the moment, legislation is going through our Dáil at the moment to make us part of a system that can manage this better across the European Union.
Some of the questions coming in. Ask the Minister if we're going to continue to hit the same people with 8% USC and over 50% in deductions. Many, on the other hand, make little or no contribution. Half of my bonuses disappear every year. That's from
this
David.
This is why budget after budget, we've increased the amount of income at which you pay the low rate of income tax. It's why now, for the first time in our history, you're now not paying the higher rate of income tax and unless you're earning well in excess of €40,000. And it's why budget after budget, I've made the case for tax reduction.
Yeah, but the temporary little tax that was the USC seems to be a permanent feature. And the whole idea, I remember talking to Michael Noonan about this, the whole idea is that everybody paid a little bit. Now there are so many exemptions and so many low rates that there are people who pay, you know, very little, if anything at all. And the whole idea was to catch the high rollers out of their gross salary, but also that everyone, even at a low salary, would pay a little bit and feel part of the system.
But that is the case. Those who are on very low levels of income, unless you're on a really low level of income, you don't pay the universal social charge at all. But for the overwhelming majority of people who are on middle income and beginning to earn middle income, they pay the USC.
A couple of questions. This one, political. Enjoying the conversation with Pascal O'Donoghue. Why did he not go for Taoiseach? Explain.
Because I'm very lucky to do the work I do at the moment and I enjoy it more than any other job I might be able to get. And I want to, as long as the people of Dublin Central will keep me, to continue to do the kind of work I do at the moment.
Another one, social welfare. What are we going to do with the immigrants who are on welfare now, even with the rate cuts? We have created a new social welfare class that will be with us for years.
But those who are coming to our country on international protection don't access social welfare benefits until they've gone through a really thorough process of evaluation. They're on a different rate of payment.
And a final one, if Bitcoin and digital currencies...
Oh my God, Bitcoin!
Were they discussed at your meeting in Washington and have we invested in Bitcoin? Increasingly, states are investing in Bitcoin. Some have adopted it as a currency. I'm not sure about that might be. One has who? Which
El Salvador.
El Salvador.
Yeah. God, Pat, we've covered off everything here in this interview.
Not exactly the poster boy for...
ending up in Bitcoin.
Are we in it?
We're not. Just to remind everybody what Bitcoin is. So all the currencies that you and I use, the euro, the dollar, sterling, they're all backed by a state. And in turn, they're backed by a central bank. The ECB backed the euro and so on. A Bitcoin is a digital currency that's not backed by a government. It tends to be backed by a private sector company. Does Ireland invest in it? No. Would I recommend Ireland invest in it equally? No. I'm a strong believer in the value of a currency that's backed by a state or a collection of states.
Pascal Donoghue, Minister for Public Expenditure. Thank you very much for
joining
us. Thank
you very much.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.